headlines, a word of praise from a top Iranian military commander for naval forces who blocked the U.S. from stealing Iranian oil in the Sea of Oman. The deteriorating health of political prisoners in Bahrain is sparking calls for their immediate and unconditional release. And Canada's dark past rearing its head again. A new search begins for unmarked graves of Indigenous children at a former residential school. This is news. Thanks for joining us. The chief commander of Iran's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps has hailed naval forces for foiling a recent attempt by U.S. forces to seize a tanker that was carrying Iranian oil in the Sea of Oman. Major General Hossein Salami thanked the Iranian forces for their prompt reaction, which proved that they are fully prepared to deal with any possible U.S. action. Salami noted that the IRGC forces had foreseen the U.S. move and were therefore entirely ready to take action. General Salami says the encounter indicated that the Iranian people cannot be defeated. On October the 25th, the IRGC carried out a heli-borne operation and secured the tanker. Naval forces then proceeded to steer the shipment to Iran's territorial waters. The vessel has now been released following a court order. Iran has become a full member of the United Nations Scientific Committee on the Effects of Atomic Radiation. Iran's accession of the body was approved by a unanimous vote on a draft resolution proposed by Australia. The resolution had several rounds of intensive talks before its endorsement on Tuesday. The UN decision to admit Iran, however, faced stiff opposition from the U.S. and Israel. Iran has had an observer status on the committee since the year 2017. The committee, which was set up by a UN General Assembly resolution in the year 1955, is tasked with providing information on nuclear radiation and its associated health risks. The accession of Iran and three other countries now pushes the membership of the body to 31. Nuclear scientist Behrad Nahai believes that joining UN Scientific Committee on the Effects of Atomic Radiation is a positive step for Iran. However, he says that he was surprised by Washington's opposition to the resolution.
I was very surprised that United States opposed Iran membership, particularly when U.S. Ambassador Richard Milk said that we don't want this to be expanded so that it loses effect. I think more expansion of committees such as this one will increase the effectiveness of the mission that they are given. So it is in general good, although at the final step, United States did not join the unanimous vote, but unfortunately at the beginning, it opposed it based on that. And another part that it opposed is opposed it because of Iran's peaceful nuclear work. Well, many of the members are engaged in illegal against NPT requirements work, and nothing is mentioned the work. So in general, it's a good move for Iran. Iran can have send some of its scientists to the mission to join the work and the effort of this committee. I think at the end, it will be a very positive step for Iran.
Iran says the consequences of unilateral U.S. withdrawal from the 2015 nuclear deal are the main issue of the upcoming Vienna talks between the remaining signatories to the landmark accord. Deputy Foreign Minister Ali Bagheri Khani made it clear that those consequences are pertaining to anti-Iran sanctions. He said that the talks are aimed at removing those illegal measures. The Iranian official further underlined that the Vienna talks are not about the nuclear issue, as it had been fully resolved in 2015 in the form of an agreement between Iran and the P5 plus 1 group. Iran and the remaining signatories have held six rounds of talks since April. A new round of negotiations aimed at removing U.S. sanctions is scheduled for November 29th in the Austrian capital. Bahrain's main opposition group is very concerned about the fate of political prisoners in the country. saying even seriously ill inmates are being denied access to essential and adequate medical services. The Al-Wafaq National Islamic Society is demanding the immediate and unconditional release of some inmates from the notorious Karain military prison. Al-Wafaq is asking international rights groups to visit the jail and see the conditions for themselves. Reports coming out of the prison suggest that inmates there are showing symptoms similar to those of COVID. There are also reports of a skin condition known as scabies spreading fast. Still, those affected are being held in solitary confinement. One inmate has been on a hunger strike to protest the lack of access to medical treatment. Rights organizations have criticized Bahrain over overcrowding, poor sanitation, and the lack of medical care in its jails. There's been mounting concern about the lives of six hunger-striking Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails, as two of them suffer from serious health conditions. According to the relatives of Ala Arash, he is at high risk of losing eyesight due to weeks of starvation. Another prisoner, Mikdad al-Kawasmi, is also in the hospital after his health condition deteriorated. Both inmates have been on a hunger strike for 95 and 112 days, respectively. All six prisoners are protesting against Israel's so-called administrative detention policy and want an end to their indefinite imprisonment without charge or trial. Human rights and international organizations have warned that the health conditions of the six prisoners are deteriorating rapidly.
For many Palestinians, detention and imprisonment are becoming a common experience. Since it occupied their land, Israel has arrested more than 1 million Palestinians, with and without charge. That includes more than 17,000 women and nearly 55,000 teens. The number of imprisoned Palestinians has substantially increased in recent years as Tel Aviv is tightening its grip on the lives and lands of Palestinians. At the moment, 4,700 Palestinians are being kept behind bars in 22 prisons and detention centers across the occupied territories. Among them, hundreds of young adults and dozens of women. That's according to the Palestinian Authority's Commissioner for Prisoners Affairs, Qadri Abu Bakr. These prisoners are kept in appalling conditions and subjected to harsh treatment. Abu Bakr says cases of medical neglect are on the rise in Israeli prisons, where hundreds of ill Palestinian prisoners are dying a gradual death. Jail authorities are paying no attention to the sick inmates, denying them access to essential health services, and preventing their transfer to medical centers. According to Abu Bakr, right now, hundreds of imprisoned Palestinians are in need of urgent medical care. Heavy sentences are handed down to Palestinians, including life imprisonment for many of them. Also, hundreds are being held under administrative detention, a mechanism that allows Israeli authorities to keep Palestinians without charge or trial indefinitely. Among those under the administrative detention, six have been on hunger strike for months now in protest at their conditions. Palestinian officials are warning that they are at imminent risk of death. Nevertheless, the international community seems to have turned a blind eye to the plight of Palestinian prisoners, further emboldening Israel to push ahead with its atrocities in and outside jails across the occupied territories.
A London university has caused a protest storm after student groups condemned a debate that included Britain's Israeli ambassador as a guest speaker. Apart from being a staunch defender of Zionism, Israel's Tzipi Hotovli also has a long history of expressing racist views against Arabs and hatred towards Islam. Press TV's Rob Carter has more about the protests outside of the debate venue in this report.
Furious students gathered outside the London School of Economics on Tuesday to condemn the university after its debate society invited Israel's UK ambassador to speak at an evening event. The university claimed the event is meant to encourage discourse about the Middle East, but a large number of Muslim and pro-Palestine students are having none of it.
These students are not just angry at the fact that the Israeli ambassador is speaking here today, but they're also venting their frustrations at the university and the debate society as well. They say that by inviting the ambassador to speak here today, they've essentially platformed racism and Islamophobia.
Appointed in 2020, Israel's Zippy Hotovely has been condemned over past comments she made targeting Arabs and Islam. She once reportedly denied Palestine's existence and famously said the Nakba was a great Arab lie.
This is against what the student body wanted. For this university, all the students here are deeply ashamed. This university has failed to recognize and represent the student body.
Someone like this person doesn't really deserve the right to speak about them. She has made comments dehumanizing an entire people. If she can dehumanize people and invalidate their right to speak, why should she have any sort of right?
So she's actually a preacher, a hate preacher, legitimizing killing children, legitimizing destroying Palestinian hope, legitimizing the expansion of settlers, brutally destroying the crops and everything of the Palestinian.
We as a Jews, we feel obliged to stand up against this racist, against this fascist, and what she presents and who she presents. And we want to encourage the students to come out again in the open for justice, for peace.
Despite the backlash and a walkout staged by students inside the debate hall, the talk went ahead. The Palestinian ambassador will also speak, but at a separate event on the 11th of November. But that hasn't been enough to calm the students' anger. Robert Carter, London.
China says the United States needs to stop all forms of official interaction with Taiwan and should do that immediately. A delegation of U.S. lawmakers is currently visiting Taiwan. China's foreign ministry spokesman Wang Wenbin says that the move violates the One China policy. Under that policy, nearly all countries, including the U.S., recognize Beijing's sovereignty over Taipei. China's defense ministry has also reacted, saying that the visit is an act of provocation.
We want to solemnly warn the American side to immediately halt the provocative acts and stop all destructive action that will further escalate tension across the Taiwan Strait.
Right after the defense ministry's reaction on Tuesday, China's military announced that it was conducting a combat readiness patrol in the direction of the Taiwan Strait. It said the move was aimed at the wrong words and actions of relevant countries over Taiwan. Beijing has repeatedly warned Washington against sending officials or having formal contact with Taiwan. This is a sensitive territorial issue for Beijing and a major bone of contention in its relations with the White House. Canada's dark past keeps haunting the nation, with a new search now getting started for more unmarked graves at a former residential school. Indigenous community leaders and survivors are leading the search at an institute near Toronto. For 85 years, the residential school enrolled between 90 and 200 students each year. This is one of dozens of investigations underway to uncover the full scope of physical and sexual abuses committed against children in those schools. The residential school system was meant to forcibly assimilate the indigenous people. Earlier this year, more than 1,200 unmarked graves were unearthed. A truth commission found that over 4,000 students died of malnutrition, disease, and suicide in those schools, calling it, quote, cultural genocide. The UK-EU divorce deal still remains a hot mess. The British Brexit minister says there's still an extremely wide gap between London and Brussels over post-deal trading arrangements.
I don't think it's true, actually, that we are growing apart, the UK and the EU, in the negotiations. We have inched a little bit closer, and there has been some movement, and that's good. We just aren't moving together quickly enough, and the gap is still an extremely wide one.
David Frost said Britain's only choice may be to unilaterally suspend parts of the Northern Ireland Protocol. He admitted, however, that his country has not reached that point yet and that negotiations will continue. The two sides are at odds over UK-controlled Northern Ireland, which has remained in the EU's single market despite Brexit. London wants an overhaul to the deal, citing difficulties in trade due to checks and customs on goods coming to Northern Ireland from the UK. The differences have raised fears of a rekindling of a dormant conflict as well as sparking a full-fledged trade war between London and Brussels. The number of refugees arriving in Italy has picked up again after the pandemic caused a sharp drop in migration flows to Europe in 2020. Italian authorities have said refugee arrivals have almost doubled since January, compared to the same time last year.
On Tuesday, Italy's interior ministry announced that almost twice as many refugees have reached the Italian shores since the beginning of 2021 compared to last year. About 57,000 people have landed in Italy, often on rickety boats, since January, the majority of whom are Tunisian, Bangladeshi and Egyptian. Migration flows to Italy witnessed a sharp drop last year due to the COVID-19 pandemic, with about 30,000 arrivals.
Wealthy nations destabilize developing and poor countries because they don't want to pay a fair price for raw materials. It's the same old story. The plan is to bully all those who do not accept subjugation.
At the weekend, Italy agreed to let 800 migrants disembark after they were stuck at sea aboard an overcrowded vessel for days. The vessel was carrying over 200 minors, including many children under the age of 10.
The vessel was granted authorization to dock by Italy's Coast Guard only hours after a charity ship had delivered urgently needed food and blankets to the people on board. Five pregnant women were also among the rescued refugees.
Il trend è in aumento.
The number of unaccompanied minors has been constant throughout the years. Minors are particularly vulnerable as they are groomed by traffickers and often end up being exploited in prostitution, forced labor or begging.
About 8,000 unaccompanied minors were among the refugees who have arrived in Italy so far this year, 14% of the total. The crossing of the Mediterranean Sea is becoming increasingly dangerous for refugees as weather conditions are rapidly deteriorating across the region. Max Civili, Rome.
And that does it for this edition of World News.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
The defeat in Afghanistan offers a chance to rethink America's war machine. But Congress is on the verge of raising military spending to $740 billion. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Peter Moss, a journalist. This article is published under the heading, After Afghanistan Disaster, the Pentagon is on track to get even more money. Stay tuned for the second part of this article, please. Biden chose as his defense secretary a board member of Raytheon, retired General Lloyd Austin, who received a payout of up to $1.7 million when he left the company. Austin was also a member of defense contractor Booz Allen Hamilton's National Security Advisory Board, for which he was paid $200,000 in the year before he became defense secretary. The revolving door was operational during the Trump administration, too. President Donald Trump's last confirmed defense secretary, Mark Esper, was a senior lobbyist for Raytheon before joining the cabinet. The company paid him more than $1.5 million in his final year. The door continues to spin. Just last month, the Pentagon's head of foreign military sales, Heidi Grant, left her government job and a day later started her new one as Boeing's vice president for business development. The closeness of the industry and the government to the point of being indistinguishable at times was even referenced in a conference. Last month, between investors and the chief executive of Raytheon, one of the largest weapons producers in the U.S. Defense spending is nonpartisan, noted Gregory Hayes, the Raytheon CEO, whose compensation exceeded $20 million last year. We are encouraged to see Congress supporting plus-ups to the president's budget that are also aligned to our business and our investments, he said. This is a story about a reckoning that gets mugged every time it ventures into daylight. A year ago, a group of House Democrats led by Lee and Representative Mark Pocan banded together to support an amendment to cut U.S. military spending by 10%. There were only 96 of them, so their amendment didn't come close to passing. But it was the start of what progressives knew would be an incremental effort to narrow the distance between military spending and common sense. Things seemed to look better this year. The upstarts had created the Defense Spending Reduction Caucus and sent a letter to Biden in March to remind him that if the Pentagon's budget was cut by 10%, it would still be larger than the next 10 largest militaries combined, and most of those are the U.S. allies. They argued that a clear lesson could be learned from the so-called War on Terror, which not only cost trillions of dollars but also took the lives of more than 7,000 U.S. troops and at least hundreds of thousands of Iraqi and Afghan civilians. The letter stated the premise of a military-centric foreign policy is a failure. On September 22nd, the $740 billion budget, which had been approved by the Armed Services Committee, arrived for a vote on the House floor, where there was a short debate on the amendment to reduce it by 10%. Representative Mike Rogers cited China and warned of catastrophic effects on the training and readiness if there were any cuts. His remark drew a sharp response from Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, DNY, who said it wasn't the military's readiness that was threatened, but the profit margins of defense contractors. The amendment got only 86 votes, all from Democrats, which was fewer than the 93 votes it got a year earlier, before the humiliation in Afghanistan. There were several reasons it fared worse, including the fact that this year the Pentagon budget came from a Democratic rather than Republican administration. Some Democrats were willing to reduce the budget only if the other party was asking for an increase. Additionally, an amendment was offered this year to cut just $25 billion plus up, and this less radical proposal got 142 votes, which wasn't enough to pass but was more than the budget-reducing amendment got. It appears to have functioned as an easy way for Democrats to signal their slight concern about military spending without going against their president or seeking a true reduction. The House approved a $740 billion budget with strong support from both parties. The budget is now in the hands of the full Senate, which is expected to vote on it soon. Despite the failure in Afghanistan, there seems little likelihood that U.S. military spending will slow down.
First methodology that the Quran uses is to talk to the emotional side of the human being.
Ya ayyuhal ladhina amanu, O you who believe, ista'inu bis sabri was salah.
And we have set forth for mankind in this Quran full of examples.
Minbar, a lecture on Islamic issues.
Islam is a way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, now let's listen to Sheikh Salim Bimji.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. The topic that we want to look at this evening is the topic of the creation of the human being, racism versus racial equality. The Prophet says, "Inna nas min Adam ila yawmina hadha." Indeed, all of humanity from the time of Adam all the way down to today, and he said this, you know, sometime in Medina, "Inna nas min Adam ila yawmina hadha mithlu asnan al musht," are like the teeth of a comb. You know, you have a comb to comb your hair with, and you look at them, all of those bristles are traditionally the same. They're the same length, little gap between them, but they're all the same. The Prophet says, all of us, you and I, Arab, Ajam, Iraqi, Afghani, Pakistani, Lebanese, you know, Indian, African, Canadian, British, South American, Latino, we're all like that comb. We're no different than one another. La fadla lil Arabi ala al Ajami. There's no betterment, there's no fadila, no greatness, no merit over an Arab, over a non-Arab. Wala lil Ahmar ala al Aswad. Nor a red over a black. Illa bit taqwa. Except because of their taqwa, their knowledge, their practice of this religion, their commitment to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. And so, we do not have racist teachings in Islam. The Quran, you cannot find me a single verse that shows that Islam is a racist ideology. You cannot find me a hadith that says that the Prophet discriminated against people of a different color, or the Imams of Ahlul Bayt discriminated. In fact, you look at the Imams of Ahlul Bayt, alayhum assalam, from the 6th Imam all the way to the 11th, their wives were all from Africa. African women from Nubia, from North Africa. In fact, research being done on the genealogy or the ethnicity of the Imams of Ahlul Bayt shows, and even we have hadith about Imam al-Jawad alayhi salam, that people didn't accept him as the Imam. You know why? Because he was too black. He was too dark skinned. And people didn't accept that. So, from the 6th Imam onwards, almost, I would say all of those Imams, from that point on, their mothers were from Africa. So they weren't white-skinned. If the genealogy and the DNA is going to impact, and a mixture of the different races of the earlier Imams will cause those changes, they can't be white, blonde-haired, blue-eyed. They have to have color to them. And if their mothers, those latter Imams, are all coming from Africa, they have to have, for example, African features and characteristics. Now, we really don't care what color the Imam is. You know, we're not like the church where Jesus is blonde hair, blue eyed. Or in the African church, Jesus has black skin and dreadlocks. We don't worry about the color of the Prophet or Imams. We're not worried about that incidental characteristic. But we have to ensure we don't paint the Imams of Ahlul Bayt to be people that they're not. As an outcome, and I want to conclude in the next few moments, is that we must realize that Islam, the Quran, and the Ahlul Bayt alayhim assalam never advocated for racism, discrimination, asabiyya, tribalism, nationalism. They never taught any of this to us. Just like a young boy or a young girl, you know, when you have a child and you take your child to the playground or to preschool, the children will play together, the white child with the black, with the brown, with the Chinese, with the Japanese, with the Korean, with the African, with the Pakistani, all the kids will play together because it's not within the fitrah, within the human nature to discriminate. But unfortunately, parents, most of the time, television, unfortunately, plays a big role in the segregation of the races, of teaching discrimination, of promoting one race over the other, of saying white is right, black is bad, or this group is good, these people are bad, keep away from them, don't hang out with those people because they're bad. Unfortunately, this is a learned trait. We're not born racists. We're born with a pure nature. We love all colors. Unfortunately, we are taught to be racists. Let me end with this last two points, that Islam as a religion, the Quran as our guidebook, the Prophet and the Ahlul Bayt as our perfect teachers, they have shown us that Islam is concerned with what is inside, what's in the heart. Islam doesn't care if you speak Arabic or English or French or Mandarin or Spanish or Urdu. Islam doesn't care if you're white, brown, or black, or yellow, or whatever color you are. Islam doesn't care if your hair is straight or curved. Islam doesn't care whether you're blonde hair and blue-eyed, or brown hair and black-eyed. These are our things that we look at. These are characteristics that you and I as human beings put too much emphasis on. And if we look back at the Quran and the Hadith of the Prophet and the Ahlul Bayt and the lifestyle of these personalities, alayhum as-salam, we would realize that Islam is colorblind. Islam is colorblind. And let me end with one verse from chapter 33, Surah Al-Ahzab, the chapter which we know very well because it has the verse of Tathir or the ayat of Tathir. But you go to verse 35 of Surah Al-Ahzab, and it gives you and I the criterion. What is the overall factors that make a person good? Look at this verse. Inna al-muslimina wal-muslimat. Indeed, the Muslim men and the Muslim women. No color. Wal-mu'minina wal-mu'minat. The believing men, the believing women. No color. Wal-qanitina wal-qanitat. The obedient men and the obedient women, no color. وَالصَّادِقِينَ وَالصَّادِقَاتِ, the truthful men and the truthful women, no color. وَالصَّابِرِينَ وَالصَّابِرَاتِ, the patient men, the patient women, no color. وَالْخَاشِئِينَ وَالْخَاشِئَاتِ, the men that have awe and reverence of Allah and the women who have awe and reverence of Allah, no color. وَالْمُتَصَدِّقِينَ وَالْمُتَصَدِّقَاتِ, the men who give charity and the women who give charity, no talk about color. وَالصَّائِمِينَ وَالصَّائِمَاتِ, the men who fast and the women who fast, regardless of color. وَالْحَافِذِينَ فُرُوجَهُمْ وَالْحَافِذَاتِ, those men who are chaste and those women who are chaste and pious, no talk of color. وَالذَّاكِرِينَ اللَّهَ كَثِيرًا وَالذَّاكِرَاتِ, the men who remember Allah frequently and the women who make much remembrance and mention of Allah, no talk of color. أَعَدَّ اللَّهُ لَهُمْ مَغْفِرَةً وَأَجْرًا عَظِيمًا, God, Allah, the colorblind Allah has promised these men and women what? مَغْفِرَة, forgiveness, and a great reward. There is no talk about color. So what is the solution to racism as I end? What is that we can take away with us tonight as a solution to tackle racism and combat this sickness in the hearts and minds of many people in our society, including many governments around the world and the apparatus that function within the government systems? The solution to racism, as Al-Hajj Malik Al-Shabazz, the late Malcolm X, Rahmatullah Alayhi, the Shaheed, as he would say, that America needs to know and accept Islam, because this is the only religion which can remove racism, this tumor and cancer of racism, from the American public. People need to know Islam. We have to recognize that Allah created us in different colors and different languages. You speak Arabic, alhamdulillah. I speak English, alhamdulillah. That's not a reason for us to hate one another. We should thank Allah that we have diversity. We have to, number two, reflect on how the Prophet treated everybody with no discrimination. As was mentioned, Bilal al-Habashi, Bilal from Ethiopia, the Mu'adhin of Rasulullah, the man who used to proclaim the Adhan to call people to the best act of worship, Hayya ala khayr al-amal. He could have chose any of the Quraishi Arabs or the people of Medina, the Ansar, but he chose Bilal. So follow the Sunnah of the Prophet. Follow the Sunnah of the Imams of Ahlul Bayt. And last but not least, we have to realize that most of our Imams of Ahlul Bayt, they married black women from Africa, from Nubia, from Sudan, from North Africa, from the Berbers as they're known. They didn't say, I'm only going to marry a Sayyid or a Sayyida or from Quraysh or from Mecca or from Medina or from the Hijaz. No, they were way beyond that. They were not trapped in these little compartments. And so we have to realize and we have to ensure that we teach ourselves and our children that racial diversity is a blessing from Allah. And don't ever think that somebody who's a different color than you, that they're lower than you. We have to respect everybody, brothers and sisters, whatever race they follow and whatever religion they follow. Don't say, well, he's a Christian or she's a Jew or he's that or she's that. No, respect all humanity.
You're listening to Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This program entitled Minbar. Our email address is englishradio@irib.ir.
Rahi Karimun Azim Alimun Halim Hakimun Mateen Ghafur Shakurun Wadud Qayyumun Ra'uf Allahumma salli ala Muhammad wa ali Muhammad ya mu'minin sallu alayhi.
Fruitful Moment with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight. U.S. leaders' credibility is sagging at home and abroad as speculation swells about a possible Trump return in 2024. We're prepared for you an article written by Daniel Williams, a former foreign correspondent for the Washington Post, Los Angeles Times, and Miami Herald, and an ex-researcher for Human Rights Watch. The piece is titled, Biden's Foreign Policy Undercut by Domestic Weakness. So far, no American ally has felt a need to react to the election debacles President Joe Biden suffered recently, notably in the state of Virginia, which his party controlled but then lost, and also in lesser votes elsewhere across the country. Usually, there is no reason for, say, a German leader to comment on a vote in a middle-sized American state. But in this case, cables sent out from foreign allies' embassies in Washington will likely need to grapple with this question. Is Biden already so wounded that in just over 3 years he'll be replaced in 2024 elections and have his foreign policy initiatives overturned by a purported nationalistic populist in the image of Donald Trump, or even by Donald Trump himself? His ratings in political surveys are as bad as Donald Trump's at their worst. Voters have begun to wonder if, with the spectacle of Biden's occasional incoherent babbling, he's up to the job of the presidency. Part of allied nations' worry centers on the growing habit of U.S. presidents to hang foreign initiatives on their own signature instead of gaining wider political consensus. In America's volatile political landscape, this trend throws the staying power of U.S. policy into doubt. If a president believes he can't get consent for a treaty from two-thirds of the U.S. Senate, as constitutionally required, he forges ahead anyway and calls it something else. For example, Anne-Marie Slaughter, a former diplomat who runs New America, a Washington think tank, wrote, "The Paris Climate Accord, signed with dozens of other countries in 2015, was not labeled a treaty, but an executive agreement, binding only President Barack Obama's administration." The same was true of Barack Obama's complex deal with Iran, known as the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, JCPOA. He called it a non-binding agreement that committed the United States to lifting sanctions on Iran. The late hawkish Senator John McCain complained at the time, "They can call it a banana, but it's a treaty." The weakness of each maneuver was evident when Donald Trump took power after Barack Obama, because neither the Paris Climate Accord nor the Iran nuclear deal was ratified in the Senate. Donald Trump simply overturned each with the stroke of a pen. This year, Joe Biden has quickly reinstated the Paris Climate Accord and wants to return to the Iran nuclear accord. But what will happen after 2024? William Howell, a University of Chicago political scientist, predicted America's whiplash foreign policy presents uncertainty among U.S. allies, adding, "Pervasive gridlock, polarization, and distrust that characterize our national politics will give foreign leaders some pause before entering into long-term, costly agreements with us." Max Bergman, a fellow of the Leftist Center for American Progress and specialist in relations with Europe, said, "I think there is a real sort of underlying concern that America's return may be temporary." He added, "Europeans are a little bit wary of following the lead of the United States." Joe Biden insisted his election last year represented a clear return to U.S. leadership in world affairs. At the G7 summit and NATO summit last summer, he claimed that America is back. Allies understood that he meant that the mercuric Donald Trump and his America First attitudes had been pushed off stage. they publicly welcomed Joe Biden with a hesitant satisfaction. But analysts said Western joy was tempered by an underlying fear that some version of Trump's nationalistic populism, an ideology with a two-century history in the United States, might in fact live on. Gerard Araud, a former French ambassador to the United States, commented, "After Biden, it may be Trump again." He added, "We Europeans, we have to learn to be grown up. We have to learn to defend or to handle our interests by ourselves." Virginia's election did not turn on foreign affairs, but nonetheless showed American populism is alive and well. The defeat of Virginia's state governor, deputy governor, and attorney general were largely built on dissatisfaction among parents with school bureaucrats, disdain for complaints about frameworks for teaching racial history. Nonetheless, by equating political control at home with an ability to lead the free world, Joe Biden set himself up for embarrassment. Since taking office, he claimed the United States must show the world democracy can work. On the eve of his trip to Europe recently for a G20 summit and COP26 climate conference, Joe Biden cajoled his own Democratic Party legislators in Congress to approve a $550 billion worth of programs to fight climate change. He warned, "The rest of the world wonders whether we can function." His chief congressional ally, House Leader Nancy Pelosi, said legislators must pass the spending measure so Biden wouldn't be embarrassed when he got off his plane in Europe. But the legislators failed to endorse the package, and Joe Biden left Washington empty-handed. U.S. allies abroad had already been flummoxed by a series of Biden foreign policy missteps that made them wonder whether about his competence. NATO partners criticized Joe Biden for the chaotic and incomplete evacuation of Americans and other foreigners and Afghan collaborators as Kabul fell to the Taliban. He enraged France, America's oldest ally, by quietly arranging a new anti-Chinese alliance with Britain and Australia, which denied Paris a $100 billion submarine deal with Canberra. The secretive partnership agreement also seemed a snub at continental Europe's importance as a strategic partner. The French Foreign Minister Jean-Yves Le Drian said, "This brutal, unilateral and unpredictable decision reminds me a lot of what Donald Trump used to do. I'm angry and bitter. This isn't done between allies." In the name of controlling climate change, Joe Biden began to curb U.S. fossil fuel production, but in order to keep American fuel prices low, he begged United Arab Emirates and Saudi Arabia to produce more oil. Since January, tens of thousands of illegal immigrants have crossed the United States' southern border unhindered. Biden appointed Vice President Kamala Harris to solve the problem. She traveled to Central America for talks about the flow. Returned to declare the trip was a success in terms of a pathway that is about progress, and didn't take up the issue again. The migrants keep coming, to the majority dismay of Americans. In the Washington Post, a conservative Biden critic traced the beginnings of the president's electoral problems in the United States to the botched Afghan withdrawal. The critic opined, "After his Afghanistan debacle, the floor fell out from under the president." On the other side of the globe, it's unclear whether China worries about Biden's image problem at home. China is convinced that the United States is inexorably hostile, no matter who is president. U.S. military leaders have labeled China a pacing threat, Pentagon language meaning it is on the military rise. U.S. naval cruisers through the contested South China Sea, which China considers its own, and support for Taiwan's separate status from China all convinced Beijing the United States won't change course whoever might be elected in 2024. China has held numerous military maneuvers around the self-governing island and staged jet bomber flights over its airspace, both as practice for a possible invasion of Taiwan and as psychological intimidation, regardless of Joe Biden's floundering at home or abroad. To counter this, Biden hopes to renew dormant alliances in the Far East and add India to the mix. But potential partners will likely think twice about joining an anti-China coalition with a perpetually wavering and increasingly weak American administration. You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. 49 meters, 6040 kilohertz for Europe, and 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iransat or BAD 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is pastoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, P.O. Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about our audio quality and other means. Thank you.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
Hame ba wujood ghudde saratani Israel mukhalifin.
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor Israel.
Wajh mushtarak hame wahdat ummat islami.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
September 2nd, 2021. On the occasion of the National Government Week, President Raisi and the cabinet members met with Imam Khamenei in the Imam Khomeini Hosseiniya during the first days after the formation of the 30th administration.
Some of the mistakes that we commit in different areas stem from the wrong culture that dominates our minds. If we consume extravagantly, if we copy others blindly, if we lead a wrong lifestyle, these result from cultural problems and from the culture ruling over minds. That is why these problems emerge in practice. Copying others and leading a flashy and aristocratic lifestyle is rooted in cultural matters. In fact, the software for these events is the culture of the country, and the wrong and deviant culture that dominates the minds of some people. You should significantly improve cultural instruments such as the cinema, art, and audiovisual media. The press, books, and the like are also cultural instruments. They should blossom in the true sense of the word. Today, a large army of enthusiastic youth are thankfully busy working on cultural matters and in a diligent way.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
If administrations and the cultural organizations of the administration help these young enthusiastic youths, great feats will surely be accomplished and indigenous steps will be taken. There are hundreds of innovative projects available to youth. When we sometimes meet with youth, we see that they are capable of accomplishing great things. Well, they need resources, and resources are at the disposal of the administration. They should be supported smartly. You should discover talents, support them, and ensure their freedom. Of course, I mean freedom within the framework of the law. And you should confront and fight against moral and cultural corruption without any consideration. The confrontation should be carried out this way. The main way to confront the enemy's soft war is to support, encourage, and appreciate proper moves in the area of culture and to stand up against wrong moves. The arena of media and culture could be, and indeed is, a great university. And on the other hand, it is a battle between good and evil, truth and falsehood. It is a cultural battlefield for fighting against those whose culture is to generate corruption in the world. We should look at it from these two perspectives.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.